Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in European Studies. I'm Liz Spragans, a host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Amanda Scott about her new book, The Basque Sororas, Local Religion, Gender, and Power in Northern Iberia, 1550 to 1800. Amanda is Assistant Professor of History at Penn State University, and she is a social and cultural historian of early modern Iberia, with expertise in the Basque Country, the Spanish Empire, and women's history, and with broader thematic interests in comparative reforms, monasticism, witchcraft and inquisition, immigration, and ethnicity in the Spanish world and Latin America. She's published on these themes in the 16th Century Journal and Church History, and has a chapter in a volume on devout laywomen in the early modern world that was edited by Allison Weber. Amanda Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So Amanda, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, where you're from, where you went to school, how you became interested in early modern Iberian history.
Sure. So I'm originally from California, and I did my undergraduate at the College of William and Mary, where I started working with Luann Holmza, and that's how I got interested in working on Spanish history, though it was sort of a bit of a circuitous route that I started working on Latin American history, Spanish literature, and then sort of started working with Luann. She took me to do research my senior year of college in Pamplona, and then everything kind of just fell into place ever since after that. I then went on to do my PhD at Washington University in St. Louis, and I worked with Daniel Bornstein, who does Italian women's history, specifically nuns, reform of women religious. And that was sort of a good thematic match. So it allowed me to kind of bring those interests in Spanish history together with like a strong focus in women's religious history. From there, I went on and I taught for 2 years at the U.S. Naval Academy. And then this last year, I moved to Penn State, where I've been, and I'm very happy here.
Yeah, no, that's great. So when you were doing your undergraduate research in Pamplona, was that also on what your dissertation wound up being? What kind of stuff were you getting to work with then?
So that was really fun. What happened was that I started taking classes with Luann, and she kind of picked aside a few students who she thought might be interested to do advanced research in Pamplona, and she started working with us on paleography, reading mostly trials that she'd copied from the AHN in Madrid. And then over spring break of my senior year, she took us to Pamplona, where we had a week in the archives, in the diocesan archive of Pamplona, as well as the Royal Archive of Navarre. And during that week, I was working specifically on clerical misbehavior, the sort of many trials of this one priest named Don Pedro de Atondo, who had sort of gotten into just a long career of violence with his neighbors, sort of family disputes, accusations over wandering away from his parish, casting magical spells, selling cures. And it sort of was just sort of the epitome of everything, a Tridentine reform kind of wrapped up into one little parish. So I did a microhistory on that as a senior, and then that ended up becoming a master's project, which I also did under Luann's direction. And then that became the article that I had in 16th Century Journal. While I was working on Don Pedro's many trials in the archives in Pamplona, I started to occasionally come across references to Sororas. And the dictionaries that the archives had always defined them just as nuns, which from the trials that I was reading became pretty clear that that was not the case at all, that they were something very specifically Basque. And so that sort of piqued my interest, but I was definitely still working on clerical misbehavior. But I kind of put that aside and decided that, that was what I wanted to work on for my dissertation. And I was kind of in a good place because I had that idea of what I wanted to work on kind of the moment I started the PhD program. So I was able to start doing research immediately and kind of really starting to have the pieces fall into place from kind of the first year. And that's kind of one of the reasons that I think I had just so many weeks in the archives that for this project, I spent over 100 weeks in the archives. So I was really able to spend a lot of time with the records. And I think that's just because I started working on that as an undergrad.
That's incredible. It's such a massive amount of time in the archives. And it's cool that you got to have some of the orientation to those, some of the same archives that you worked with as an undergraduate feature really prominently in your book. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's frustrating that I know for a fact I have not actually read all of the records on the Sororas. And I mean, that's just like, to this point, it's like impossible. You're never going to find everything. And you're always going to keep finding more things after you've already finished the project. Like I was just looking through one of the catalogs yesterday and I found another reference to actually an interesting trial involving a Sorora that I had just completely missed before. But it was useful because I was able to establish really good contacts with the archives, and the project kind of grew over time. That I started off thinking it was going to be a fairly specific story about how the Sororas acted as kind of watchdogs in the parish, sort of reporting back on kind of the misbehavior of their priests, conflict with their parishioners, and sort of becoming sort of this this way for the diocese to understand what was going on the ground. But as I continued to read that, it got a lot more complex. It grew over the course of two centuries, and it started to involve a lot more archives than just Pamplona. And that was partly due to the fact that I was able to spend so much time starting early, but also to sort of add new archives and new collections over the course of those 7 years of grad school.
Yeah, that's incredible. So maybe as we transition into having you talk about the book, you could just start off by telling the audience what is a Sorora? Why do they matter? What's really cool about them?
Yeah, that's always the tricky part with this. I'm like, oh, Sorora. I was like, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, nobody knows what a Sorora is. So sure. So the Sororas are essentially devout lay women that are hired by the parish and licensed sort of like the male clergy, examined sort of like the male clergy, but in a position that's very specific for women. And they're only in the Basque-speaking lands. So the Basque country is a little bit blurry to kind of define it the way we do today as a political unit. The way I treat it in the book is sort of a cultural and linguistic area of northern Spain. But in any case, there are a lot of sort of older Basque traditions, older Basque ways of doing things that carry over and get sort of redefined and called something that kind of makes more sense in the early modern period to Spanish speakers or to kind of people that are kind of coming in between those two worlds. So the Sororas then in other places or without kind of more knowledge of what they do specifically in the Basque country would look a lot like the tertiaries in Italy or the Beguines in the Low Countries, sometimes like the Beatas of Castile. But the big difference between what they're doing in the Basque country and what these other women are doing elsewhere in Europe is that the Sororas hold a set vocation that's paid. They receive a stipend. They receive a place to live. They sometimes pull their pay from something similar to a benefice. So in those ways, they look a lot like the male clergy, though they're not doing pastoral care like the clergy would be doing. The other interesting thing about the Sororas that puts them in a different light than those other kind of quasi-religious women is that they don't take any vows. So that is different from what nuns would be doing, which they would take three formal vows, sometimes supplemental vows, but sort of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And the sororas only take informal promises to do those things, which means that if they don't like the job that they have, they can go back to the secular life and without sort of perjuring themselves as a nun would be doing and would be accused of apostasy and sort of subject to the diocesan courts. So what the sororas do then is that this job sort of gives them a place to be neither fully a nun, but neither a married woman. So they don't marry. But it gives them a place where they can be single in a respectable role in their communities, serving their communities, doing work for the community that is absolutely crucial for the kind of upkeep of religious sites. And in return, they're given kind of this prestigious role in the community. They're paid and they can hold on to this through their entire life. They have the job security through death, actually. So it's a very special position for women that is unparalleled anywhere else in Europe. And I think what I sort of argue in this book is that this sort of expands the way we think about women's place in early modern Spain, but also prioritizes some of these sort of regions that we don't necessarily think about when we're thinking about women's role in Reformed Catholicism.
Super, super. So one really tiny question that I had. So we were talking about all of your work in the archives. You were talking about how sororas are sort of this unique Basque phenomenon. What percentage of the archival sources that you were working with were in Basque versus Castilian, Aragonese, Navarrese?
So all of them are in Castilian. Occasionally there is a phrase or a word that's in Basque. And depending on the archives, definitely this is the case in Gipuzkoa. The catalogs for the archives are in Basque. And that's a feature of kind of cultural groups volunteering to catalog the archives, and they do it in Basque. But that's sort of anachronistic because the trial itself and the written records are in Castilian. The interesting feature about this is that that's a little bit misleading because increasingly as other work, not my own, but like other scholars are showing that the Basque region, including Navarre and fairly south, far south in Navarre, as far as Tudela, was probably monolingually Basque or at very best sort of bilingually Basque and Castilian. So all of these people would have been speaking Basque, and due to the nature of early modern trial records in Spain, for privacy, there would have to be a translator on the scene. So the deponents for these records would always be speaking in Basque, but the translator and the notary would then be translating on the fly into Castilian. So conveniently for me, that means that all these records are in Castilian, which I read and speak fluently. I was able to pick up like enough working reading knowledge of kind of phrases and sort of topics that I would encounter in Basque, but I don't speak Basque, and it's a very complicated language to learn, especially in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was wondering, so as you were describing that process, to what extent did you have to think about the accuracy of those records because of the kind of on the fly translation that was happening? Was that a thing that you grappled with in your methodology, or was that not a concern for a particular reason? Yeah, please.
The closest places that I see some kind of confusion about terminology is trying to translate things from Basque into Castilian and not having exact words. So the word sorora is the best example of that. And I think that's leading back to what I said about kind of how the dictionaries always defined it just as nun, which is incorrect. Castilian inquisitors or court functionaries or anybody kind of producing these records who are not from the Basque country, and a lot of them were, but we're still working in Castilian. They didn't have a good word for sorora. So oftentimes they would just say sorora, which was helpful, but sometimes they would kind of draw upon other words, which actually was useful because that kind of gave me a better sense of what the sororas were and sort of their the linguistic roots for the term. So sometimes they would use other words which are pretty clearly Latinized Basque. So they would say freira or freila, sorora rather than sorora. They would use variations of kind of bringing words that sounded like wax in to kind of maybe relate to the liturgical roles. Or they would just be kind of Latinizing it, bringing the words, the Latin words for sister in. So that was able, that kind of keyed me into the fact that this is a different position that they're unfamiliar with and they're trying to define it. So I don't think it was actually an obstacle. It actually was kind of helpful to kind of clue me into the fact that, yes, the sororas are something that is unique to the Basque Country and therefore hard to define.
That's super fascinating. Thank you for that really interesting answer. So again, continuing, I'm super interested in your methodology. So as we've said, this project came from this massive and extensive engagement with sources from several different archives. Can you talk us through your methodologies for approaching these sources? You know, when you were confronted with such an enormous quantity of material, you know, you have this great picture in your introduction of just the like stacks on stacks on stacks on stacks mm-hmm. of legajos in one of
it's
these
like a
archives.
Football field.
Yeah, like so, you know, I'm sure that you were just overwhelmed with this wealth of material that you had to sort of pick and choose from. How did you make those choices? How did you decide on what to hone in on?
I basically had to kind of have a different method for each archive, and like I said, I started off just working in the two in Pamplona, which fortunately had really good catalogs. The one in the diocesan archive, the ADP, that one only had paper catalogs, but like in book form, but they're constantly editing new ones. So there would be new ones coming out and they would have sort of inconsistent, but still very interesting indices, both by name as well as by place and sometimes by topic. None of them included sororas in those, but the newer editions that are coming out are starting to include those just because they got familiar with me always asking about them. So that's kind of a nice, kind of interesting feature about how the archival arrangement of collections can change based on the way researchers are using them. In the General Archive of Navarre, in the Royal Archive, which is housed in an old castle and has seven floors, subterranean floors of just an immense amount of material that most of it is not in the area that I needed, but they have good notarial collections as well as criminal trials. That one I could use a local area network program that they had in the archives to do keyword searches and by names. So what I was able to do, what I started doing was I started triangulating between people between those two archives, which was sort of a tool I started experimenting with when I was working on clerical misbehavior, trying to look for those priests in the secular archives where they should not have been. They should have their trial should have been handled in the diocesan archives. But I started finding them occasionally in places that they should not have been, suggesting that people were starting to draw upon different jurisdictions in ways that they figured would benefit their cases, and that sometimes even priests were able to bring in certain very specific cases, bring cases in the secular archives rather than the diocesan archives, and likewise that they would show up in wills or in other places. So I was able to get kind of a fuller picture working between those two archives, trying to triangulate personnel. Once I started getting some grants, and I think this is the crucial part to doing a project like this, which I just like to like call out and say, like, it's really important. We have year-long grants for grad students to do projects like this, because you can't do a book like I wrote without being in the archives for a solid 13 months. What I was able to start doing then was bringing in some of the other archives. So my project, because I was working across jurisdictions as well as across administrative regions, and some people's projects wouldn't have this be the problem if they were working in just one diocese in Italy, for instance. But I was working in Navarre, which had the royal jurisdiction of Navarre, and then the Pamplona diocese, which covered part of Navarre, part of the French Basque Country, part of Guipúzcoa, and then occasionally part of Tudela, and then another diocesan jurisdiction, Calahorra, which covered another part of it, and then in Bilbao, and then up into the Basque Country, which was yet another diocesan jurisdiction. So across all of those, I had a whole set of other diocesan archives. And then as I got out of Navarre, I had other sets of notarial archives as well as different criminal archives. And so basically, as I started adding more archives, I had to kind of new methods of looking to do that similar triangulation, which was not always possible because with archives that have their collections lost or destroyed, sometimes you just can't do that. But I did that whenever I could. When I couldn't, which was more of the case in Bilbao, because their much of their diocesan collection was their diocesan criminal collection is gone, and then a lot of their notarial records are in a state you can't read, that they're falling apart. What I had to start doing there was just looking for different things. So that's sort of the feature of some of my later chapters as they start to kind of focus in on more. On certain areas where I was able to look at trials in a different way. But I guess basically the kind of wrap up of that question is that the methods changed depending on where I was and if I was able to do that triangulation, as well as if I was using criminal trials versus notarial records versus diocesan archives. And then there's a whole bunch of other archives I ended up going to that were just sort of for fun. To see if, like, oh, I have a few days, like, I might as well go see if there's anything that's similar in Barcelona or Salamanca or Avila or Santiago de Compostela, just to see, to make sure that the sores truly were only in the Basque Country, but then to kind of contextualize what was going on in other dioceses in Spain at the same time. And so that was a lot of fun that I was able to just kind of have so much time to go play around in archives, and that I think is also another reason why those really long-term grants are so crucial.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as somebody that's done archival work in other places in Spain, just getting oriented takes so long, like getting familiar with the 7 different volumes that they have the archive indexed in, or, you know, the 25 different volumes.
Try like 43 and growing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, so that's great. I have one last methodology question, and I hope that it's relatively short. But so you say in your introduction that you begin your study after male clergy had solidified their control of Christian devotion. And so you wind up with as the title to the book states, you wind up with 1550 to 1800. Why this time frame? What is so critical to you? I think I understand the end date, the 1800 date makes sense since, as you say, sorors kind of get phased out, as it were. But why the start date? What's so interesting about that start date?
So that start date is not as exact. Like, I could have chosen probably a specific year, but it's, again, like, I think that would be a little bit almost too specific. So what that is basically for the Basque Country, and since kind of my primary archival base is Pamplona, since that had both the regional jurisdiction archives as well as the diocesan archives that covered the largest portion of the area. What that 1550 is about when the diocese started keeping a good archive for the criminal trials that the diocese was overseeing as part of this would be a little bit early for saying, oh, this is like a direct effect of the Council of Trent, but elsewhere in Europe, this would be an effect of the Council of Trent, that they should have better archives and better kind of record keeping at the diocesan level. What happens in Spain is that at least this is my kind of take on this based on my experience in other archives, is that there's no consistency on when dioceses started doing this, and also kind of what their program with archival record keeping would be. So, for instance, I was in Valencia last summer, and a lot of their records were burned. So it's not a great comparison in terms of just the size of the collections. But what they seem to do in the diocese, in the Tridentine period after kind of Catholic reform really gets going, is that they seem to focus much more on the finances of the parishes and the diocese. And that was sort of their direction of reform, of being like, we're going to just get our money in order. Whereas Pamplona really focused more on criminal pastoral correction, that they were going to go after people that were not doing the right thing, in a rather rather severe terms, and that the courts for Pamplona expanded extensively. So when I say that this is about kind of the male clergy taking kind of hold on this, that is a kind of a shorthand for saying like what's going on there. As this kind of plays out in more broad terms in the Basque Country, what this is not a direct cause and effect, but it's sort of simultaneous with some of those older traditions of sort of more matricentrical women's household devotion kind of getting swept into a more focused wave of Catholic renewal in which the male diocese is in charge. And sort of the strange feature of this is that while that's happening in the Basque Country, the sororas are also kind of really becoming a more crucial element in helping implement reform in this sort of very male way in the diocese. And they're given a very specific role in this process, and their job is sort of protected because they prove themselves to be so useful in this. So 1550 then is really just kind of the date that I can kind of start to track all of these different things, like good record keeping mainly, and good larger collections across the archives, combined with the fact that we're starting to see a lot of those features of Catholic renewal and reformation.
Awesome. So then I have just one final sort of context question, and then we can move to chapter one. So throughout your book, you highlight the tension of the local versus the global that so defined many parts of the early modern Iberian experience. And I was hoping that you could maybe talk about this paradox in general, and then explain to me or explain to the audience how it comes to bear on your book in particular. So how do sororas, another way of putting it would be, how do sororas get situated within kind of the field of global Iberian studies?
Right. So I think that this is a feature for early modern Europe in general, that this increasingly global presence, like globalizing a force of the world, as being felt in Europe and by people. And so I think we have to think about the globalization of the early modern period as not just sort of these forces that are that are separate from the local experience. Carlo Ginzburg had a really good quote on this a few years ago, which was that there can be no global history without a deep knowledge of the local. And for anybody who's read any of Carlo Ginzburg's work, obviously that's sort of like, you know, he's selling his own point, which is that like microhistory matters. I'm not doing a microhistory here because, again, I'm working over 250 years across a lot of different areas, and I'm not really following one person. I have a few case studies, but not sort of the deep history of one kind of otherwise unknown person. What I do think is important, especially for early modern Spain and specifically for the Basque Country, because, you know, we always think about early modern Spain as being sort of the test case for empire, that like, what do sort of the early modern empires look like? Spain is the first empire where the sun never sets, even though England gets that terminology later. It was Spain first. So to have an empire like that, it's full of people and it's full of things going back and forth. And so in the Basque Country in particular, for a variety of different reasons, and this is much more the case in the Basque Country, like proper as we consider the Basque Country today, but also to an extent in Navarre, a lot of immigration in the Spanish kingdoms was not anybody could just immigrate, and certain provinces were had the ability to immigrate. So in the Basque Country, there was a lot of immigration due to kind of some class statuses, but also just because of some of the skill sets that were unique to the Basque Country in mining, deep sea fishing, iron work, a lot of things that skills that were kind of in demand for long range global travel. So what happens is that you have a lot of people that are moving around in and out of the Basque Country. You have a lot of men who are gone for long periods of time. And you're able to kind of track this in a specific way in the Basque Country that I think it's harder to look at in other areas that don't have kind of that set, very specific identity that the Basque Country does. This is not something that's necessarily new also in the global period, that this sort of long history of men being gone for long periods of time as a feature just for a long time in the Basque Country with the men who are gone on the fishing fleets and the whaling up into Newfoundland, and then also shepherding across the Pyrenees. So I really refrain from doing kind of these cause and effects of saying like the Sorores, you know, received so much power and kind of prestige because men were gone. And I think that's too simplified and like that I really, really didn't want to make that argument. However, men were gone a lot and certain structures did evolve in ways that made sense to the community. And the Sorores, having women take these roles, having a lot of women who weren't going to get married in the first place, but also having kind of a lot of wealth come back in interesting ways that needs to be kind of put into place in the local communities, gifts to churches, testamentary gifts from the New World. All of those things kind of come together in a way that I think we can see in the Basque Country that you might not be able to kind of track in all those different ways elsewhere in Spain.
Awesome. Thank you for that. That's so true. And I think that remembering that it's not just about, you know, the periphery versus the center, that it is this sort of fluid relationship, particularly in somewhere like the Basque Country, where there are these like ethnic and nobility laws that are allowing for some people to travel, whereas other places in the Iberian Peninsula couldn't.
Yeah, and I think it's also just sort of a feature of modern boundaries to like think about the Basque Country, or even if we're going to get up into Asturias or Galicia, to think of those as peripheries. Those would not have been peripheral in the way we would define peripheries today. That the Basque Country, the Basque Country had major ports of entry, major shipbuilding hubs in Bilbao, a major port of departure right outside San Sebastian. And then Navarre occupied a major, some of the better routes of crossing the Pyrenees, less high routes. And so in terms of people, goods, information, books, money, weapons, witches, all sorts of things kind of going back and forth on the border, that the border is not a periphery. We think about a borderland as peripheral today, but that's actually very central in that sense if we're thinking about kind of the transfer of those important goods. And then if we like think about, this is outside my own scope of my work, but Alison Posca's work on women and sort of the Atlantic empires in how that's felt in Galicia, again, like seems to be a very peripheral region as we would define it today, but it's absolutely central in looking at kind of the effects of men being gone for so long in the Atlantic empires and how that actually plays out in society. And so I see some of the very similar parallels with what I see with the Sororas happening through her work in Galicia.
Yeah, that's great. So as we move on to the content of the individual chapters, I thought we could begin chapter one just with an outline of the difference between lay and monastic religious life, and then go in for some of the kind of specific manifestations of lay female religious life in the late medieval and early modern period in Europe that you talk about in chapter one.
Okay, so chapter one, some of that appeared as an article I had in Church History. And then I expanded it with some more kind of specifics about some sort of case studies with the Sororas and sort of how it breaks down. So this kind of comes back to what I was saying earlier about how we would define Sororas differently if we didn't know more about them, how they would just look on the surface like any sort of other devout laywoman. So I kind of use those terms so comfortably that I forget like devout laywoman or quasi-religious woman. That sounds like I know exactly what that means, but to somebody else, I think those are a little bit clunky. So what they essentially just mean is that we often think about, you know, women having two options in the Middle Ages, that they could be nuns or wives. You know, that obviously ignores the fact that there was a lot of, you know, that elite women could be nuns or wives, that a lot of other women just never married. They worked, they were prostitutes, or that they, passed in all sorts of other parts of society. But if we're talking about kind of in the specific terms of what women could or could not do with honor, I guess, we think about those two options, wives or nuns. But in fact, a lot of women chose a third option, which is what we would call a tertiary, sort of those devout lay women, which are going to be kind of nuns, that they live like nuns, but they are not kind of bound by the same strictness of nuns. And specifically, they don't take those vows that I mentioned before. So they often live in little communities. Sometimes they would test the waters and later become a nun. And that's more of the case with sometimes the Beguines of the Low Countries. Or they would sort of like try that out and then maybe they would go get married later. Italian tertiaries, these are often going to be attached to mendicant orders like the Dominicans or Franciscans, or at least have sort of a member of one of those male orders kind of overseeing the women's group. They might live in small groups, lead a contemplative life, or do some charity. But generally, they're going to be kind of poor. They're going to live a simple life. The Beatas of Castile, very similar to those Italian tertiaries, similarly doing kind of charitable or sort of humble life, kind of managing to support themselves, so without kind of the support of a large formal monastic community, but without sort of the strictness, but I guess maybe also the stress of those formal vows, that it's a much more fluid and flexible life. They get to stay closer to their families. Or if they can't afford the cost of entering a formal convent, it's also more, more feasible. So the sorors then, like I said, kind of complicate this because they on the surface seem like, oh, they're just doing they're like tertiaries. They're not taking formal vows, so they must be tertiaries. But the big difference is that they are employed by the parish churches to do work for the parish in a way that we might else in other circumstances call like a sacristan or some of the other kind of varieties of parish employees, which today, if people are familiar with the Catholic Church, would be more common to see women in these roles. But in the past, women would not be in sort of a formalized position. The other group that I compare them to in chapter one is also the anchorites a little bit. And that's a kind of just because I do love the anchorites. And I think that they provide some good examples because we think about, the flexibility of the tertiaries or the Beatas being in their communities. And then we think, oh, well, the anchorites, if they brick themselves into a wall, they're not part of the communities anymore. It's a severe, extreme monasticism. But in fact, bricking yourself into the wall of your church is the best way to stay part of your community, that everybody's going to see you just about every day. And you could just imagine anchorites just being bricked into walls, just shouting at people like as they walked by, people coming to visit, like passing babies back and forth, cats, food. And so I think though the sorors don't get bricked into walls, I think that idea of being in another form of religious life that is so central to the community actually does look a lot like that other kind of aspect of anchoritism. And I just love the anchorites too. So
I love that description of the anchorites. I feel like since coronavirus hit, I've seen a lot of articles in like The Conversation and stuff describing, you know, the 21st century experience of quarantine as being like being an anchorite. But it sounds like it's not. It sounds like on your vision of it, it's we're being a whole lot less social than anchorites would have gotten to be.
This last spring, I taught a course on women in European history as an undergraduate course. And, you know, midway through, as like things started to collapse, I gave them an assignment to do a meme, to make a meme about something they better understood from the class now that quarantine and coronavirus had hit. And I had some on anchorites insofar as like maybe that tension between like you're locked in, but you like are still like wanting to like shout and connect with people. But I think actually probably one of the better examples would be the stylites, but that's out of the scope of my book. But the old desert hermits, if you're thinking about you're just sort of like you're disheveled quarantine creature, you smell bad and yeah.
That's wonderful. That also sounds like an amazing project for undergraduate. That's great.
Oh, they were so funny. A bunch on Marjorie Kemp also, that somehow she struck them as really kind of speaking to them through their quarantine. I guess it's the shrieking and the misery. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So as you kind of talk about in the book, and we can get into the specifics of your position on the Council of Trent a little bit later, but sort of the usual account of the Council of Trent is that it's this, you know, set of reforms that is like all about centralization and sort of top-down control of the local by higher authorities. As we've talked about, you sort of don't, you're interested in back and forth and not in just sort of one way imposition of power. You know, what did the Council of Trent or what did Tridentine reformers find so problematic about all of these other sorts of laywomen that you describe? Like, what threat did they pose to the reforms that the Council of Trent wanted to impose?
So I know this is probably going to jump ahead a little bit, but actually one of the things that I do argue in the book is that a lot of the programs that Trent had in mind don't fully come to fruition until the Bourbon reforms, and for a completely different reason. But one of the things that Trent is trying to do is to sort of trim things down and make things work a little bit better in a way that's going to be, to put it cynically, less embarrassing for the Catholic Church when they're thinking about kind of what are the Protestants making fun of them for? What are sort of things that are falling apart or who have gotten kind of, maybe if you imagine this like a tree that has grown too many branches over time, and to kind of trim it back to the trunk and kind of get to something a little bit more austere and more pure. So what happens for the most part, where I come at this, and I don't deal with some of the bigger structural changes for Trent, but there's a lot of changes in terms of trying to get the clergy to better respond to the needs of the parish. And that's where I think there's often kind of, we forget like, oh, actually, yes, Trent is responding to what's going on in the local circumstances, and it's not going to work unless people are on board with it. So this kind of comes back to some of my earlier work, and maybe a little bit more into chapter 3. I don't know if we've skipped ahead to there. What it does kind of on a practical sense for the way most people are going to feel it is it spawns a lot of synods, so meetings at the diocesan level about how they're going to attack certain changes. And what happens then is you see these sort of eccentric and very specific lists of decrees that are tailored to the localities, to the diocese. And for the Diocese of Pamplona, this is published. You can look at it online. It's really good. The whole 1590 synod. So they're a little bit late to get to this. They have a few false starts earlier. But finally, with the 1590 synod, they address everything. And much of what I find most interesting are what happens with clergy who are not acting like priests, or that are getting too close to their community, specifically that they're acting too much like lay people and you can't tell them apart. And that is sort of the hallmark of kind of late medieval Catholicism, is that like you have these very embedded priests who like are illiterate. They basically just act like they're parishioners because they're one of them. They're like a local boy. And so what's interesting with Pamplona is that they actually like say, actually, we do want local. We want local clergy. We don't want somebody coming from afar because we don't want them to wander away. If they're local and we just make sure they're better educated and better trained, they will stay put and they won't embarrass anybody. And they moreover won't abandon their parish. And that's the big problem that they're dealing with, is this sort of absent clergy. And so that's kind of where the sororas come in, is that I see that them kind of filling the gaps and being there to help the clergy, but also being there when the clergy aren't there. And that's one of the reasons that the diocese sort of lets them alone. I guess coming fully back to Trent and your question about kind of how it addresses specifically women like this, Trent doesn't address women like this. They address monastic orders, nuns. They have some decrees on kind of reforming monastic orders, but there's a decree shortly after Trent that's sort of generally considered part of Trent, but it's separate. It's called Circa Pastoralis, and that deals specifically with devout lay women saying like they need to get themselves into convents. We already dealt with this in the older decree by Boniface Paracoloso, like get yourself cloistered. Don't get out of your convents. Like, we only want religious women who are in convents acting like nuns. And if you're not doing that, you no longer are going to be able to do this. So that essentially says no more devout lay women. But then you see a lot of women that are like, oh, but actually, like, I am serving this purpose. And the sororas as a whole group managed to kind of write out both Trent and Circa Pastoralis all the way through the 18th century because they're able to call themselves basically something different and say that they're not nuns, they're not devout lay women, they're really helpful.
And so do you think, I mean, you said that you don't like to sort of say that because, you know, the Basque lands were particularly unique, that left a space open for Sereras that maybe wasn't available to women in other parts of the Iberian Peninsula. But what do you see as being particular about the Basque country that facilitated the emergence and then protection of this kind of peculiar institution that you don't see in other parts of the peninsula?
Some of this has to do with stuff that's not going to become important really until the 18th century, which has to do with the ways laws are passed and sort of the old fueros in Navarre about how Navarre actually is an autonomous kind of governing unit. It's a kingdom separately from Castile. And so laws have to be ratified in different ways. So they can't just sort of change things without sort of the agreement of the three estates in Navarre. But elsewhere, I would say that kind of you see kind of glimpses of this in other points. So in chapter 5, I talk about witches and witchcraft. And I found a few references to Sororas being accused of witchcraft, not as many as you'd think, but they do seem to be vulnerable to that. Like a woman living by herself in a shrine on a hilltop, like clearly a witch. But what happens is that sometimes when you have what I see in those cases, in the case that I talk about in chapter 5, is Castilian inquisitors coming in and having this sort of clash of cultures. That the deponents in Navarre, so the witch hunts are in Navarre, they're talking about the sororas and they're being like, oh, of course, like, you know what sororas are doing. And they're clearly kind of like trying to key into that understanding of what culturally sororas do in Basque culture. And it's completely lost upon the Castilian inquisitors. And they're like, okay, yeah, sure. A soror, fine. We'll write that down. But like, they don't see the full importance of what they're talking about.
Great. So then speaking of what they're doing, that's so important. Chapter 2, you talk about,
sorry.
No, that's great. That's a perfect segue. You move from describing kind of the range of devout women, lay women throughout late medieval and early modern Europe to focusing specifically on the sororas. So what's the relationship between the sorora and her community? What does she do? How does she become one? What are the sorts of things that govern her behavior, day in the life of the sorora?
Yeah, so this is, I guess, like this interview is running into the same problems I had when I was trying to organize my book, which is just like, how do I even start talking about this without describing what they are? But then, like, there's all these other things I want to talk about. So, yeah, it's difficult to say, like, well, it's also the problem of, like, dealing with, like, that there's no other book on the sororas, so I can't like just like say like, oh, as you know, as you already know what a sorora is. Okay, so basically, like, if you just have like the job description, it'll sound kind of boring. Like, they did a lot of cleaning. They cleaned churches and they set the church up for the priest, and that's sort of the basic job description. But individually, I see references to them doing a lot of other things. So I'm pretty sure they're, like most Basque women in this period, would be illiterate. However, they do seem to have some role of working with the wardens, the church wardens, and keeping records. So they would at least kind of communicate what is in the church, what things have been coming in and out, like as gifts. So they would be keeping track of materials. Cleaning, obviously doing these things that that do fit into that kind of idea of like the domestic role. So very kind of, this is a very part of like the gendered aspect of this. But there are actually some of them I see doing some very interesting things. So a few references to sororas helping dress the priest, which would have been a fairly scandalous no-no after Trent, and probably before Trent too, for that matter. lighting candles, doing some of the kind of some of those liturgical roles, a lot of funeral work. And this is something I don't really talk about in the book because I know that they're doing this based on kind of other references, but I never actually find kind of documentation that lays out what they're doing as part of the funerals. But I'm pretty sure that they are actually washing bodies and helping with the families to grieve. They are educating young girls. Again, that's something that I see from kind of tangential other references, but I don't see necessarily in the records themselves. Locking and unlocking the churches, helping pilgrims, washing kind of travelers as they come through, sort of generally like everything you'd expect of kind of a caretaker for a church. And where I see the references to these, if that's also part of the question, is in the job descriptions of when there's a transfer between one soror to the next when she dies. So all sorors, especially after those the synodal decrees saying kind of listing kind of the problems, one of the things that the synod does is says that like the sorors need to take out a license and be examined. So that kind of puts them in light with the male clergy. And what happens then is when a soror dies and the next one comes, she has to produce the license of the previous soror. And then there'll be testimony from the parish about why it's so important to have somebody do that job. So you'll see kind of like both kind of what the ideal job description is, as well as kind of why people think it's important.
And so then how did somebody become a sorora? So you have the job description, you've talked about how these were in fact, you know, official positions that the diocese recognized. How does one become a sorora?
So after that synod, it does say that they're supposed to be 40 or older, which would put them outside of childbearing age and presumably outside like people being sexually interested in them, which is sort of probably just a fiction. But I see a lot of sororas that are a lot younger than that. And then they like, they'll come up with reasons about why that's okay. Like, so kind of backing up, like somebody becomes a sorora because she wants to become a sorora. And then the community says she'd be a good sorora. And that's where you see kind of some of them kind of bending the rules. Well, they'll say like, well, you know, she's been talking about this ever since she was a child, which again, sounds like a fiction. Sometimes they live with a sorora and they kind of help the older sorora and then they sort of take over after that. But some of them do seem to generally like genuinely have that vocation, like nuns. Sometimes they say like, I've always just wanted to be a nun. I saw this as a life that I wanted to pursue. So you definitely see sororas testifying that like they always knew that they wanted to do this. They were familiar with what the sororas did and it's inspiring to them. When they want to become it, they have to wait for a position to open. It's generally because like too many in one place, they become like impoverished and there's not enough work for them is the fear. And then they, when the position opens, then they can become, they can take out the title. They'll have to have nominations and the town will vote on them and then they'll be installed. And then they're kind of, they'll present the application to the bishop and then there'll be sort of some questions and some examination. And what's interesting, kind of coming back to what I was saying before about like the younger ones that come in, they'll come up with some very crazy reasons about why, like, it's okay. Like, you know, it's not going to be dangerous to have this 18-year-old, like, taking care of this, like, rural shrine. And they'll be like, I'm so ugly to look upon. Like, nobody would find any sort of emotion other than just complete mortification to, like, look at me. Or, though I am young of body, I am old of soul. That's another popular one. But a lot of younger women will do it, too. And I think that just speaks to the fact that this is a good job. It pays. It gives them a house. They know what they're doing for the rest of their life. They can live with other women, but they don't have to remove themselves to the community. And they get kind of an honorable, prestigious role that is respected and protected.
So how did the financing of that work? Like, where did the money come from to pay for this good job?
So I see most references to that actually coming in from the 18th century when they're starting to repeal or kind of close some of the shrines and they'll kind of pull up older records about how these things are paid for. Generally, they will be on a system that's similar to a benefice and they might actually be pulling a portion of a benefice. So This is still the age of split benefices, which is a whole other problem that multiple clergy could be sharing one benefice and basically be impoverished because of that. But sometimes benefices, especially in the 16th and 17th century in Spain, are so complicated before they get reworked in the Bourbon reforms that they're going to have a lot of kind of like caveats and like extra little things. And so the sorors often will have some money that's tied specifically for their upkeep coming out of the benefice. Other times that they will just have to be paid directly from the priest, and that'll be kind of a requirement of the priest taking the benefice is that he has to employ a soror and a sacristan and a servant for the soror or something like that. Other ones just kind of collect money kind of haphazardly, like they draw a portion from the benefice structure like that, but a lot of their money will come from alms, which makes them sound like they're paupers, but I think that those are actually probably considerable alms and they're sort of expected. They're not sort of begging for them. They're just like, yes, you tithe the soror and you give the her money. Others are going to have kind of lands attached to their shrines and churches. So similar to the benefice structure, but like they're not like major producing lands. It's going to be like a garden and like a portion of an orchard. And others, almost all of them actually will receive gifts upon the death of anybody. So part of the law in Navarre in the Basque Country is that when somebody dies, there's so many pieces of bread and so much money that has to be given to the church.
So you talk in the beginning of that chapter about the importance of this symbiotic relationship between the sorora and her community. So they're valuable jobs. They pay women, effectively a living wage. They are paying them enough that these are desirable positions. What does the community get out of the presence of these women in their presence?
Well, for women in particular, they have kind of a closer confidant, sort of a maybe somebody that they feel more comfortable kind of coming to. So that's sort of like kind of generally, I could say that that's a draw. Very practically, they have somebody who's like looking after the church, especially if the priest is going to be gone. They have sort of a familiar face who's keeping track of everything, and they can be sure that their hard labor in kind of donating to the church, building things, like decorating it, is going to be taken care of. And they know that it's being watched and it's not going to be robbed, theoretically. But also, it's sort of a face of what their labors of donating to the church accomplishes. So rather than just sort of like slathering the decoration, they know that kind of what they're doing is that they're supporting this member of the community.
Great. So chapter three, to kind of circle back to the earlier Council of Trent conversation that we started, how does the sorora story inform your vision of the Council of Trent? Or the effects of Tridentine reforms? Like, what does this bring new to the sort of traditional story that's gotten told about the Council of Trent?
So again, I come at this mostly from the synods, which I see as part of the Council of Trent, because this is kind of Council of Trent at the diocesan level happens through synods. And for dioceses that don't have synods, basically there's no Council of Trent happening. Like, there's no Tridentine reform unless they're getting together discussing how it's going to happen. Navarre is very enthusiastic at the Council of Trent, and this is not my own work. This is older work by José Goñi Gaztambide, sort of the big historian of Navarre. That Navarre is well represented at Trent. They come back and they're enthusiastic about having those synods, even if they don't get going right away. I think what I see as sort of the main contribution of my work to understanding Trent is the kind of recognition through the lens of the sororas that unless there's some compromises that are made, both in terms of leniency as well as in terms of things that the localities want that are actually farther than Trent is willing to go, unless that there's compromises on those things, that Trent is not going to, the Tridentine reform is not going to take hold in the diocese. So it's not like, I don't see this as a fully top-down process. I see this as kind of like, here's the things we'd like to do. And then the locality saying, okay, but you know what? We actually really do consider that pastoral residency is mandated by God. And Trent is like, no, it's a recommended. But Navarre, the synod, goes farther on that. And I think that's a recognition of the fact that they really do need their priests there. And then similarly with the sororas, the fact that they're able to find a way to keep them and to actually kind of legitimize them through kind of redefinition of what they are. And by that licensing and titling and examination process, that the fact that they are willing to be lenient on that aspect allows them to be successful on others.
And so you talk about how that kind of licensing process and the diocesan kind of legitimizing of Sorora's position in their society leads to bishops and other church officials kind of cultivating Sororas as their informants on the ground. Is that, would you say that that's an accurate characterization?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see certainly the bishop ever writing to the Sororas being like, tell me all you know. And the visitations for this period are haphazard at best and possibly not happening very often, which is another kind of failure of Trent, is that there should be like yearly visitations, but it's unclear. Sometimes there seem to be surprise visitations, which seem to be kind of against, like counter to the point of a visitation. But mainly what I see is this sort of redefinition of the Sorora as not a devout laywoman, but as a diocesan employee. And that means that she is sort of exempt from those decrees saying that that there can't be uncloistered religious women. And as a diocesan employee who's getting that title and that examination and the stipend, she's serving a particular purpose. And the diocese is able to say that, well, we don't have to reform her because we just employed her and she's this employee and it's working really well.
Great. Okay. So then as we kind of talked about before we started recording, it sounds like you're going to get to talk about a lot of the second half of your book on another channel of the New Books Network. So I'm not going to have you go into nearly as much detail for chapters 4 through 6. But I was hoping that you could maybe dig into one story from one of these chapters. You had mentioned earlier that you were really interested in witchcraft trials, and I thought maybe you could tell us one of your stories from your case studies in Chapter 5, The Witch of Nuestra Señora de Santa Cruz.
Sure. So Chapter 5 is a triptych chapter that has 3 case studies, and they don't go in chronological order, but they kind of set up Chapter 6 in terms of looking at sort of gendered aspects of the sororia, less so from the sense that I said before that like it is by definition a very gendered job in terms that they're doing domestic work that would be appropriate for women. But I look at in these chapters kind of some of the breakdown of how sort of suspicion of what might be going on in the sororia, how that leads to accusation and sometimes how sororas fight back against that, or how sometimes the community is like, no, of course, that's not happening. We know exactly what's happening in the sorora and it's fine. So what I do in Chapter 5 then is I look at kind of 3 of the most common kinds of suspicions, which again, with the caveat that like there aren't too many cases of sororas being accused of witches, but the ones that are really, I think, illustrative. There is kind of the main one that I talk about in the chapter, which happens during the big witch hunts of the early 17th century. There's a number of other ones, which I don't talk about in the book, that are from the 1570s in this earlier case, this kind of earlier mini spat of witchcraft accusations. And then also in Chapter 5, I look at sort of the accusation that sororas are just running party houses, kind of common like accusation against nuns in general that like, you know, they're just a bunch of lazy women who are like hanging out all day. And then the other one is that they're using sort of the secrecy of the sororia to have lovers, which I think is probably actually a fairly legitimate claim, and probably one that's like generally like when it happens is accepted by the community. And I talk a lot more about that in chapter 6, that again, like I don't think like all sororas have lovers, but I think like the case in older medieval Europe that a lot of times it's sort of expected and sort of looked the other way when a priest has a mistress. The same thing happens with the sororas. So back to the witchcraft case then. That one, I mentioned a little bit earlier, what's interesting about that one is just sort of the disjuncture between local informants and the Spanish Inquisition in this case. So non-Basque, non-Navarrese inquisitors. And so what happens in this case is that this woman named Maria de Andara says she wants to confess to witchcraft. She's dealt with the kind of the famous witch hunting book, The Witch's Advocate, as well as the Sora that I talk about here, Catalina de Sopalde. And what happens is Maria de Andara says she wants to confess and goes through kind of the very classic confession of what happens at a witch's Sabbath. And the Basque witch's Sabbaths are crazy in their own way, that they're very classically the topsy-turvy world where everything is backwards. But the really interesting feature of the Basque witch Sabbaths is that the witches are very closely tied to toads, and they have like toad pets, and some of the witches have like toad little toad herds of toads, and the junior witches look after those toads, and like it's all about toads. They feed children toads. Toads are falling out of pockets. Anyway, so she goes through her witchcraft confession. Kind of the magic number 3 on the third time she says she will become a witch. But the key to this is that she doesn't do this voluntarily. She is brought to the witch's Sabbath by a sorora, and that the sorora is able to uniquely use her position with access to women in the parish, access to kind of secret spots in the parish, access to the shrine, that she's able to kind of have this midnight vigil and bring women to the church. So usually her role as being sort of this trusted confidant of the community, somebody that is supposed to be the ideal kind of Basque woman. And she's able to use this and turn it into become the ideal Basque witch. And she's able to use her trust to lure people to the witch's Sabbath. And so that seems to be kind of the angle that Maria wants to take with this accusation, that she turned into a witch, but really the bigger problem is that the sorora is the witch. By this point, Catalina is actually dead and in jail, but I don't think Maria knows about this, or else it's just that she's able to use kind of the accusation of somebody who's already dead. But the main point is that what she's trying to do is say that the sorora is the witch, and the bigger problem is not me, little Maria. It's the fact that you've got a sorora who has access to the parish, and she's loose, and she's a witch, and she's recruiting new witches, and she's the devil's favorite witch, and she's the perfect witch. So what happens then, and this is coming back to this sort of disjuncture between local knowledge and kind of elite expectations of what women are doing, is that the Inquisition really does not seem to pay too much attention to this. That they say, okay, yes, the sorora, sure, she went to the shrine, blah, 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 like we'll deal with her later. But they don't kind of take seriously the level of threat that Maria is trying to communicate there. And so it's, you know, the case study is not really, I don't have something really conclusive. Maria does get off, and she goes back to the community. But the interesting thing to read there is the fact that like most sororas were not accused of witchcraft. Most people did not turn them in as witches. But when they did, they seemed to have done it for very specific reasons that made sense in a Basque context, but which was missed by the Inquisition.
I mean, it's really fascinating because one of the things that people talk about with early modern witchcraft trials is as a way of controlling women that get too powerful. And so you would think that with this population of women that does have power and control over more space than your typical early modern woman might, and that has more mobility and that has financial independence, you might expect that those sorts of accusations would be more common. Is your sense of why that doesn't happen? Is it just that they're so well situated in the communities?
Well, I think that they do have a lot of support by the communities. They have a lot of enemies sometimes, especially if there's a contested nomination and somebody else wanted it. But what I kind of start to argue more in the later chapters is that there's a tension between turning over that local autonomy, the local control over the sorora, and giving too much power to the diocese or to the courts of what's going on locally. And so saying that anything is going on wrong with the Suarez automatically kind of opens up that door for like the bishop to come in and be like, oh, really? Do you need more help here? Like, I'm happy to like change things for you. And the parishes, of course, want to kind of maintain that local autonomy. And so kind of accusing the Suarez, even though they seem to, this is the interesting thing with the witchcraft trial, they seem to know that that should be something that the Inquisition would be interested in. And like you say, that they should be the kind of women that are kind of the stereotypical witch and like take the power away. They seem to restrain themselves, even though they're aware that that's an option. And Maria kind of resorts to that when it's crucial, like her own life is at stake, but does not, it kind of falls flat. And I think that's largely because the Sorors, what they do is not understood outside the Basque and Navarrese context.
So I don't want to take away too much from the other New Books Network podcasts, but I would just love, since we're also getting on the long set, I would just love to have you kind of summarize what you think some of the big takeaway points from your whole project are. Like, why should readers want to go check out this awesome book?
Well, I think there's probably something for everyone. On the one hand, I do think it's interesting to look. There's not a whole lot of work on the Basque Country in English, and I think it is just a fascinating region to study. And one of the things that's really special about it is just the wealth of the archives. So one thing I do try to do in the book is be very upfront about my methods and about kind of my writing and research style. And just sort of the wealth that these archives, kind of the projects that are allowed. So I think for grad students who are interested in sort of thinking about archival work in a post-pandemic world, this kind of can be a model of what do you do with that much material and kind of like how do you even start to do it? And one of the things I didn't mention earlier when I was talking about my methods is another feature here is that the archives are open for so limited hours that I did a lot of writing in the afternoons. So what that meant is that I worked on the chapters across the whole book simultaneously in kind of groups and wrote them in pairs or trios as sort of a part of the organization of what I was doing in the archives in the mornings. So I hope some of that comes out and that could be helpful to students trying to think about how to organize a lot of material. From a kind of just purely historical sense, like you're not interested in archives, that's fine. Something's wrong with you. But if you're interested in just sort of looking at kind of the way that we might connect periods of reform over time, that we often look at the Tridentine period as separate from the Bourbon period. And like, there's not a whole lot of reason to look at them together because one are royal reforms and one are church reforms. I think we can kind of see how some of those things that get started with Trent get kind of meet full fruition by the Bourbon reforms with the reorganization of the benefices and parishes. And that if we're not looking at history over time, like those, I'm not doing a long durée history here, but kind of looking at things that, you know, you wouldn't notice that full fruition if you were just looking at 100 years. And again, that's a matter of that I was lucky with these archives, but kind of looking at how these sort of temporal periods that are convenient for us might be kind of hiding some other answers. And then for people that are just interested in women's roles in local communities, as well as in shaping reform and policy, I think the Suarez, with their just the wealth of their records, give just a completely different view on the opportunities and limitations that women faced during this period. And we often think about Catholic reform as being very limiting for women, taking away that that option of devout lifestyle outside the convent. But the Sorors show just that there's actually a lot more flexibility that we might otherwise ignore.
Awesome. So I've taken up loads of your time. I super appreciate it. Before Sorry. I let you no, it was wonderful. You had some amazing, fascinating answers. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you're working on now. Like what's book two?
Sure. I'm still working on the sorors a little bit. I'm working on an article on St. Ignatius's sister, who was a sorora. So this is going to pull earlier than my book, but he had a half-sister who was a sorora. So I'm looking at a little bit on the influence of Basque women in the role of sorors and how that might have affected the Jesuits' early receptivity to women's spirituality. And also, I think nobody really remembers that Ignatius' sister was a sorora, so that's interesting. That's going to be an article. My next book project is called Pilgrim, Pastor, Pauper, Spy, The Case of Pierre de Praxelier. And it follows an amnesiac pilgrim priest coming down from France on the Camino de Santiago during the Wars of Religion, who was arrested near the border in Spain and examined to see if he is a fake priest or and perhaps a spy. And so what I do in this, what I'm doing in this book is looking at kind of that trial from four different lenses. So pilgrim, pastor, pauper, spy, and considering how evidence looks different depending on the kinds of questions we ask. What's really interesting about this trial, aside from kind of just being able to do that, is it just reads like a movie, like a memento, that the guy has amnesia. So he carries a bunch of notes with himself and his handwriting helps him remember. He has a lot of travel passes, which the community finds absolutely suspicious, that something must be like suspicious here if he has that many travel passes, obviously. But he can't kind of remember where he's been or where he's going. So they embark on a lot of forensic processes to try to determine who he is and what's going on, including doing a blind criminal lineup, which is something that's just like unknown for this period, retracing his routes, his travel routes. And eventually they send him on his way, give him another note, and probably the exact same thing happens in the next town over. So it's sort of this, it's changing gears a lot, but it's obviously really fun to work on espionage, and it's like a movie. So, yeah.
That sounds so fun. I can't wait to see how it develops further. So thank you so much for taking, yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you about your book. Take care.